Today I want to focus on most of my remarks on the interplay between the recent stresses and problems of our financial system, particularly the credit capital markets, and the reality of persistent global imbalances. But let me begin with a brief summary of a subject that I'm sure is top of mind for many of you in the room, and that is the current state of the economy and the reasons for the recent actions by the Federal Reserve. In recent months, there's been a sharp deceleration of economic growth. The pace of job creation has slowed. And at 4.9%, unemployment is measurably higher than it was a few months ago. When I came to the Fed just last March, unemployment stood at 4.5%. Troubles in the housing sector have been well publicized, with house prices declining in many parts of the country. These developments have led many observers to express concern that the economy is going into a recession. Also, with the surge in energy prices last year, recent measures of inflation have been elevated and above my personal comfort zone as a policymaker. In response to recent economic circumstances, the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, has acted decisively. Over a period of 9 days, from January 22nd to January 30th, the FOMC lowered the federal funds rate 125 basis points from 4.25% to 3%. Since last August, the committee has dropped the federal funds rate 225 basis points. These actions were taken to avert the fear of a deep and protracted economic downturn. In the face of economic weakening, the FOMC acted to avoid a restrictive posture and to move rates toward a level that might support a stronger pace of growth in the second half of 2008 and into 2009. You may also be aware that in response to recent strains in financial markets, the Fed has injected liquidity into the financial system. In December, the Fed introduced something called a term auction facility as another way to address immediate liquidity needs in financial markets. I believe recent actions helped address the risks to the economic forecast just referenced, that forecast being weakness in the first half of 2008, followed by improvement in the second half, with inflation moderating from recent levels. The liquidity injections and easing of monetary policy should help housing and financial markets stabilize and avoid an adverse feedback loop in which a decline in housing prices fuels financial market volatility with spillover to the broader economy. These immediate, seemingly domestic economic challenges demand attention. But I believe it's important to keep in mind the larger context that our economy continues to deal with the reality of persistent global imbalances. So I will take some time this afternoon to comment on the interplay between periods of financial system stress, the actions and policies required to remedy system weaknesses, and the reality of continuing global financial imbalances. Some of these thoughts are in the nature of a hypothesis. They are my tentative views and those of members of my economic research staff at the Atlanta Fed. I am in no way speaking for the Federal Reserve or my colleagues on the FOMC. To set the stage for this discussion, let me review some of the key evolutionary trends in banking and credit over the last 20 years. The choice of 20 years is a little bit arbitrary, but I remember a strategic consideration of these directions prospectively in the mid-80s when I was a corporate banker working for Citicorp here in Atlanta. I will cite four trends that I see as formative of our current situation. First, credit intermediation has evolved from bank-centric to market-centric. To a substantial extent, the modern model of the banking business, particularly for larger banks, is that of originate to distribute. This means that banks work with business clients and consumers to create a loan, but often sell the loan into a secondary market for such assets. Secondly, the business of credit has evolved from the old style of booking a loan and holding it to repayment to the financial technology called securitization. The loan is securitized. A pool of many similar loans is packaged and then funded in the debt securities market. Securitization has been one of the major financial innovations of the last two decades. The master security is then broken into tranches with different risk and return characteristics. A native Georgian, Charles Sanford, who rose to be the head of Bankers Trust, wrote an article back in the 80s foreseeing this. The article was entitled Particle Finance. And as I recall, Charlie Sanford envisioned particles of risk and reward, and he meant that credit and financial risk would be parsed, tranched, and transformed into derivatives to match the exact risk and return preferences of diverse lenders and investors. Along with securitization, the growth of derivatives, financial contracts based on price fluctuation of a distinct asset, commodity, or risk, has been a major innovation of our age. Third, for many banks, particularly our large banks, lending to corporations has evolved from general corporate lending to leveraged lending. For some time, it's been the case that banks seldom make direct loans to the top-rated corporations, especially when the bond markets offer a better deal. The rise of the private equity industry offered a lending alternative with better fees and spreads. Financing leveraged buyout transactions has become a big business for many banks, and these loans, too, have been sold off into secondary markets. Fourth and finally, credit extension to American corporations and consumers has evolved from domestically funded to global distribution of securities and loans. There's little argument these days that capital markets, including credit markets, have become global. To some extent, this is in response to the accumulation of large pools of dollar capital held offshore. I want to explore in my remarks to come this notion a little bit further. Analysis of the causes of current financial market instability cannot ignore the possible role played by the interconnected phenomena of trade imbalances, savings and investment imbalances, fiscal imbalances, and foreign-owned dollar surpluses. Such imbalances have emerged as a persistent and, some would argue, ominous feature of the global economy as the world's goods markets and capital markets have become ever more integrated. I believe it's important to recognize that this aspect of globalization is both effect and cause. The effect is that large, mature countries like the United States are able to be net debtors to the rest of the world for sustained periods of time. But in addition, the channeling of capital from net saving countries is itself a cause of financial market, product, and deal innovations as banks try to design investments to appeal to investors, including foreign investors. In my view, analysis of the causes of current financial instability cannot ignore the role of foreign dollar surpluses. Looking at economic history over the past few decades, it appears that the recycling of large dollar surpluses has presented recurring challenges. My career actually involved direct dealing with both offshore dollar surpluses and the resulting challenges. In the early 70s, I worked in Saudi Arabia when the first momentous oil price change occurred. The world was flabbergasted in those days when the price of oil went from $2.50 a barrel to around $12 a barrel. The oil-producing countries suddenly generated enormous, or at least enormous for that time, dollar surpluses that need to be invested elsewhere in the world. There was a rush of lending to developing countries, especially Latin America, that seemed to offer so much growth potential and, in turn, high rates of return. Borrowing countries and their bankers overindulged, and the flow of capital resulted in what was called the LDC, Less Developed Country, debt crisis of the 1980s. At that time, I had the job for 1 year of swapping bad loans in South America bad loans of South American countries for equity in their local companies. The point of this commentary is that the accumulation and investment of large pools of dollar capital in the hands of institutions and individuals abroad may have direct linkage to periodic financial market cycles in this country, both rises and falls, as well as banking system problems. This argument was recently put forward by academic economists Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, Reinhart of the University of Maryland and Rogoff of Harvard, draw a line from the channeling of petrodollars to South America, to South American sovereign debt in the 70s, to disruptions of the U.S. banking system in the 80s. Whereas the large foreign dollar holdings of the 70s and 80s were channeled through banks to a risky emerging market debt, in recent years, the accumulation of dollar holdings abroad helped finance risky U.S. household debt, again with banks in the middle. Each period of financial market systemic stress, regardless of root causes, is followed by the predictable period of sharp adjustments and reform of the financial markets and its institutional architecture. The interaction among all the factors I have mentioned, trade imbalances, global saving and investment imbalances, market innovation, and reform, is complex. It's tempting to carry analogies from the past too far. At this point, conclusions about cause and effect are really more speculation than science. But I'm persuaded that the liquidity conditions created by foreign-owned dollar surpluses trying to find an investment home in this country contributed to the market's recent unstable conditions. I'm also persuaded that these financial balances are not likely to disappear in the foreseeable future. We must live with them, and policymakers must be mindful of them. Why are they likely to persist? One reason is that the U.S. dependence on foreign energy resources will last for some time. Another is that the conversion of large population surplus-generating saver countries such as China or Japan to consumer societies will also take some time. So will the conversion of the United States to a saver society. If you need to be convinced of the scope of this transition, just consider the primacy of the U.S. consumer in world product markets. By one measure, nominal U.S. consumer spending was 18%, almost 20% of gross global product in 2007. This nation will need foreign-owned dollar capital well into the future. As we address the recently exposed inadequacies of our financial system, as we implement necessary fixes, we must not discourage foreign investors. What could do this? The answer is the same whether you are the recipient country is a small emerging market or the largest economy in the world. Inward investment is discouraged by, first, seemingly arbitrary changes in legal and tax rules, including changes favoring local resident interests, confiscatory treatment of property and assets, including financial assets, excessive regulation, capital controls, and investment protectionism. Let me elaborate on some of these. In my view, we should not rewrite the rules of the game after the fact. The efforts of private sector players with the encouragement of the U.S. Treasury Department under the banner of the Hope Now Alliance initiative promotes a voluntary framework for mitigating subprime mortgage foreclosures. This effort stops well short of loan restructuring by government fiat. I support this approach. It is far better for the parties in financial arrangements to work through the process of apportioning losses by mutual consent or through traditional adjudication channels. In my view, we should not, in the pursuit of market order, impose excessive regulatory constraints that might undermine the innovation and competitiveness that are, in the long run, the foundation of a thriving financial market and institution system. Finally, in my view, we should not become identified with investment protectionism. Trade protectionism is widely understood and debated. Investment protectionism refers to differentiated treatment of capital providers based on national identity and citizenship, as well as denial of certain investment opportunities to non-residents or non-citizens. There are some legitimate national security concerns in certain industries such as defense, but such concerns can be easily exaggerated. Much has been written and said recently on the latest concern, sovereign wealth funds. Sovereign wealth funds are special purpose investment vehicles sponsored and overseen by governments to allocate some of their foreign currency reserve or dollar surpluses to a diversified portfolio of securities and direct investments. I've had some direct experience with sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East. I share the views expressed by a number of commentators, sober and sensible in my view, who argue that we should not misconstrue the intent of these investors and exaggerate their threat to our national welfare and security. I think it is far-fetched that investments would be made for nefarious political purposes and that they would or could somehow impose non-commercial decisions on investee companies. In my experience and observation, sovereign wealth funds, the management of sovereign wealth funds, are serious, responsible, commercially minded, and professional stewards of their country's wealth. I think concerns about sovereign wealth funds can be overwrought. To the extent that trade and capital account imbalances are the source of potential instability, the answer is to address fundamental causes. The opposite fear is abandonment by foreign investors of the dollar and the United States as an investment destination. We need not, in my opinion, fear a precipitous wholesale withdrawal of foreign-owned capital. The most extreme versions of this scenario are simply not possible. Though some diversification of global capital will proceed from the natural reapportionment of economic power as economies and capital markets develop, the United States and its currency remain at the center of the world's trade and investment system. So long as we follow sensible policies, the cost to the global economy of materially altering these arrangements would be far too high. To close, let me summarize the thesis presented here and add a few thoughts. The United States has experienced periodic episodes of financial system stress followed by curative adjustment and reform. We are in such a period now. Large and persistent global financial balances are contributing factors. The accumulation of large dollar balances owned by foreign parties must be recycled into investments. Large investment volumes resulting from concentrated dollar holdings abroad encourage financial innovation, but also excesses. There are excesses because popular investment products and popular investment strategies are pushed beyond prudent limits under the pressure of competition and linear assumptions. If global imbalances are unlikely to disappear for some time, and we must live with them, then market practitioners and financial authorities must improve their ability to monitor global investment flows and recognize incipient problems. As I said earlier, there is a fair dose of conjecture in these ideas. They deserve further exploration and research. My colleagues and I at the Atlanta Fed intend to do this. With that, let me thank you very much, and I would be happy to take your kind questions.